Welcome to the Accenture MIT podcast series. Here's Daniel Jackson, professor of computer science at MIT.
What makes a good software design? Imagine that someone gives you a large software system consisting of thousands of components and asks you to tell them whether it's well designed or not. You could look inside the components individually and see how well constructed they are, but that would be a lot of work. Is there some way to determine the quality of the design from the overall structure? This is the question that David Parnas addressed in a famous paper entitled Designing Software for Ease of Extension and Contraction. His interest was how to design a software system so you could easily extend it with new functionality and contract it, namely by removing parts to obtain core subsystems that you could reuse. The main idea in the paper is what he calls the uses relation, which is a graph that he constructs between the components of the system and then evaluates to determine how well the system is designed. Here's how the graph is constructed. We simply make a node for each component of the system, and we draw an edge from component A to component B when A uses B. This means that A requires the functionality of B to work properly itself. To put it more precisely, A uses B if for A to meet its specification, B must meet its specification also. Here's an example. A browser might have the following components: a GUI, a graphical user interface, a network module for sending and receiving HTTP packets, a parser for HTML, and a display component that takes parsed HTML and displays it, using the GUI component. Assuming that control resides in the GUI component, we would expect it to use all the other components. If the parser includes code both to get the HTML and to parse it, then it would use the network module to get the HTML. If instead the parser just gets given the HTML, we would expect it not to use the network module. Now imagine that we have the users relation shown as a graph. We can now do some useful analyses with it. Suppose we want to reuse one of the components in another program. Well, we know the component won't work unless we also take any components it uses, and they in turn will require the components they use. So to find what Parnas calls the minimal subset associated with a component, we have to trace forward from that component in the users graph and collect up all the components that are reachable. Ideally, this minimal subset is small. In the worst case, it includes every single component, which means that you can't reuse a part of the program at all without bringing everything else along. If the parser uses the network module, then it means that another application that needs an HTML parser can't use this one without also taking the browser's networking code. That would be very bad. The program we want to reuse the parser in might not even have any networking functionality, and if it does, it may be incompatible with the networking module in this browser. Another example of a bad design would be if any of the components used the GUI. When you build a program, it's very likely you'll later want to change or replace the user interface. So you want to design it so that the user interface uses the other components and not vice versa. This is not so easy to do in practice. Think about how the GUI gets written to. Some component wants to write a message to the GUI, but we don't want it to call the GUI directly, since that would result in using it. The standard way to solve this problem is to use a construct called a listener. The GUI creates this object and passes it to any component that wants to write to the GUI. Now the component, instead of calling the GUI directly, calls the listener instead. The listener has been constructed so that a call to the listener will result in a call to the GUI. So the GUI will end up being called after all. This might sound like a rather roundabout way of doing things, and indeed it is, but it works very well in practice. You might wonder how introducing the listener could possibly help. The key reason that it helps is that the listener has a simple and loose specification, something we discussed in my last podcast. And having a component use that isn't nearly so much of a liability. The only code you need to take along with you is usually the specification of the listener, which in a language like Java is given as an interface type. Nowadays, people more often use the term depends on instead of uses, and the graph is often called a dependence graph or a dependence diagram rather than a uses relation, but it's the same thing. So far, we've talked about minimal subsets for reuse. But the uses relation has many other applications, dare I say uses. Here are three particularly important ones. Whenever the component is modified so that its specification changes too, we can trace through the users graph to find out which other modules might be affected also. This time we trace backwards. If A uses B and B's specification changes, then A might change too, and anything that uses A, and so on. So the users graph tells you what the impact of a change might be. Suppose you're the manager of a software development. The design phase has been completed, and you have a dependence graph showing all the components and their relationships. Now you want to allocate components to subteams for implementation, that is, to make an appropriate division of labor for the coding phase. How should you do that? Well, the graph tells you which divisions are likely to be good ones. If two components related by users are allocated to different teams, then those teams will likely need to talk to each other. So if you can allocate tasks to minimize the number of dependence edges or users edges between teams, you will minimize communication between teams and make it easier for them to work independently. That's the second example. Here's my final example. What order should you write and test modules in? If A uses B and B isn't yet written, you won't be able to test A, unless you're willing to write a stub to take the place of B. So to minimize the need for stubs, you want to construct the system following the dependence graph, starting with the leaves, those components that don't use another component at all, then the components that use those, and so on, all the way up to the top. So far, the criteria we've talked about for judging a dependence graph or users relation have relied on rather detailed knowledge of the particular application domain, such as knowing that other components shouldn't depend on a GUI or that a parser shouldn't depend on a network module. But you may ask, are there more general and simpler criteria? It turns out that there are. The first one is an obvious but useful one. Every edge in the graph is a liability, so the fewer edges you have, the better. If you have a choice of making your component use nothing or using something, have it use nothing. If you can depend on two components or one, then depend on one. The second criterion for the general shape of the graph is that you want to avoid cycles. Whenever you have a cycle, all the components on the cycle drag each other along. Moreover, cycles make programs hard to understand. Just consider the simplest case of a cycle with A using B and B using A. Where do you start to understand this? You can't understand how A works until you understand B, but likewise you can't understand B until you understand A. Actually, it's not really as bad as this, because you don't need B to understand A, you only need its specification. But these mutual relationships do tend to complicate things. The third criterion is that a large system should generally be organized into layers. The components of a layer can depend on each other, and the components in one layer can depend on components in the layer below. But a component should never depend on a component in a higher layer, and preferably shouldn't depend in a layer two down either. The simplest example of layering is a program divided into application code and libraries. This rule then says that the application components can depend on the library components, but the library components should never depend on the application components. There are a variety of layering models used for different applications. In information systems, there are usually at least three layers, one for the user interface or presentation, one for business logic and data manipulation, and one for data storage. Because the dependence graph tells you so much about the structure of a software system, you should construct it when you design the system and adjust the design to give you the dependencies that you want. But whether you did or not, it's useful to extract the dependence graph from the code when the implementation is complete. Then you can compare it to the original designed graph, or if you never had one, use the extracted graph to try and understand the designer's intent. There are two parts to extracting a design with a dependence graph. The first part is extracting the dependence edges themselves, that is, determining whether a component A uses a component B. This is actually very hard to do accurately, so in practice tools do some pretty crude things. For example, if you see A calling a procedure declared in B, you'd say that A uses B. If A references a variable in B, that is generally taken to be a use of B by A, but it could mean the opposite. Subtyping makes things even harder, but it's possible to get a reasonable approximation that it's at least a starting point for a more careful analysis using these kinds of fairly shallow and automatic analyses. The second part is trying to determine from the dependence graph what the layers are. In principle, this is very straightforward. You start with the components that use no other components. Those go on the bottom layer. Then you find the components that use them. They go on the layer above, and so on. In practice, this isn't so simple, because there are violations of the layering principle. So what you do is try and come up with an order for the components that makes most of the dependencies go from components higher in the order to components lower in the order. This is what tools based on the Design Structure Matrix, or DSM, do. The Design Structure Matrix is just a matrix representation of a dependence graph, in which an X in row I and column J means that component I uses component J. DSM tools typically allow you to group components into larger packages, and then to order these packages to show layering, and they include algorithms to compute these groupings and orderings automatically. They also allow you to declare rules about what kinds of dependencies are allowed between certain packages or layers, and they can then continually examine the code as it evolves, flagging any violations of the rules. Sometime soon, I expect tools like this will be as much part of the build cycle as standard compiler checks are today, so that when a programmer makes a mistake and introduces a bad dependence, it will be caught before the damage is exacerbated. Because they can show large dependence graphs in a compact form, DSMs are being used by researchers to examine the structure of large systems. Alan McCormack and his colleagues at the Sloan School, for example, have used DSMs to compare open source and proprietary implementations of applications. It seems that the open source versions often have more controlled dependencies. This is not that surprising, since open source systems rely on developers working together with less communication than developers who are co-located on a team. So a system with a wild dependence structure would be very hard to manage as an open source project. That's all I have to say today about dependencies and their applications. In my next and final podcast in this mini-series, we'll discuss some new paradigms for separation of concerns.
Copyright 2010, Daniel Jackson. Music copyright 2010, Chris Bremer from pianosociety.com.